As I say, I want to get to our next guest here. And we'd had him on the show previously, and this was something where I really got great feedback about this the previous time we had him on, approximately a year and a half ago, episode number 62. That was about the time that his huge best-selling book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, had come on. It detailed the fall of Bear Stearns. He, in his capacity in writing for Fortune magazine and for other outlets like the Daily Beast, he's always chronicling any number of things here. He did for Vanity Fair, the story about the Huffington Post and the controversy on some of the origins of that. And he has a new book coming out on the role of Goldman Sachs in world markets. And additionally, I just found this out earlier in the show, was the instructor at one point of our previous guest on the show, Liz Klayman. Actually, she had been in a class that was taught by him at one point. I could only be speaking of William Cohen, who it's our pleasure to have back on the show. William, good to have you back tonight, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. That is quite an introduction.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take you on the road with me.
We try to put our guests over strong, and you know, it's pretty easy to do based on all the stuff that you've done. And I didn't even know earlier tonight, until that point in time, you actually had taught Liz Klayman. I just happened to mention you were coming on later in the show. I was setting up to ask her a question that I was also going to talk to you about, and she remembered her time in your class very fondly.
Well, she was a great student, and it's nice of her to say that I was a good teacher.
Well, she really did. She as well put you over very strong, and I have to say, again, it was a pleasure having you on previously and getting to read your book. And you know, I'm pretty much a layman when it comes to some of these matters of Wall Street, but probably pretty much in keeping with our target audience on the show. So I feel like certainly if I can understand the subject matter that they can, and you really did a good job of breaking it down with that book. Now you've got this new one coming up. With Goldman Sachs, and certainly, you know, they've just been just a huge flashpoint, really, since this global crisis emerged now about almost 2.5 years ago. Everything you've written on, from their bonuses to some of the internal operations of the company and the way that they've operated. And there are those who hold them up as a paragon of the free market. There are those who hold them up as the embodiment of pure evil. And based on everything I've seen thus far, your book is going to do a very good job of navigating through and getting to the heart of the matter, good and bad.
Well, you know, one of the things I like to do, this will be my third book I've written about Wall Street after working on Wall Street for 17 years, is, you know, I'm a real believer in the need to tell the story of these firms through the people that work there and the crazy things that they do. And it's how they say, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I think that, you know, in the book that I wrote about Lazard Frères in New York and Bear Stearns and now Goldman Sachs, the things that these guys do, the things that they do in pursuit of riches, fame, fortune, power, you know, becoming masters of the universe, just sometimes defy logic, defy imagination, and that is what the real discovery is for me. It's just, you know, I'm constantly amazed by the things that they do and the things that they try to do and the roles that they take in our society, how powerful they've become, how seemingly unaccountable for their behavior they've become. Often it's not a pretty story, and I think that until we really understand their behavior, and I try to make it in as readable narrative way as I possibly can, sort of like a great sports story, until you do that, you can't really understand what they're doing and what they need to change and what we need to help them to change so they, you know, don't get us into another fix again.
Well, it's been your ability to do that, I think, that's really helped folks like myself to be able to discern what the core of the story is, the way that you set up the narrative and you go through. And as you say, look at all of the human elements that are involved in it. And something like Goldman Sachs, I mean, I would think in many ways they probably exemplify so many of the puzzling matters of the major global markets today that we talked about it previously when you were on the show, these matters of incentivizing certain behaviors. And Goldman Sachs, it seems like, for better and for worse, they really are very strongly involved in that. You talked about previously a lot of times executives not having enough skin in the game. It really does seem like you start to get into what they call casino capitalism with the way that some of these firms operate, where – it just seems to be, I'm not saying necessarily with them, but it could be in some instances, shortcuts and essentially chasing that profit motive at the expense of anything else that's healthy to do.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, and basically, what happened on Wall Street, you know, for anybody who is sort of following our recent history of financial crises, which seem to be coming faster and more furious all the time. I mean, in the last, 20 years, 25 years, we've had, maybe 10 different financial crises. I mean, usually they were averaging sort of one every, 30 or 40 years. There was a period after the Depression and a bunch of securities laws were passed and the Glass-Steagall Act was passed. We went from basically 1929, 1930 until, sometime, in the early 70s before there was a real financial crisis again. And that's, 40 plus years, and it seems to me that in the last 20 years we've had 10 financial crises, and I try to figure out in my books why is that? How has that happened? Why are we having an increasing number of financial crises in a very short period of time? And the thing that I've concluded, having worked on Wall Street, as I said, for 17 years, is that in and around 1970, and I think we talked about this last time, in and around 1970, as Wall Street firms that were once, private partnerships that had their partners' capital in them, and they didn't have very much capital, and so they had to be very scrupulous and careful about how they used that capital, beginning in around 1970 with a firm called Donaldson Lufkin Jenrette, DLJ, which went public, and then Merrill Lynch went public, and then slowly but surely every firm on Wall Street went public. Goldman Sachs went public in 1999. Lazard, which I wrote my first book about, went public in May of 2005. And what this did is, not only did it allow the partners at the time to cash out big time, and I mean really big time, but it also created a new culture. It went from a partnership culture where partners were on the line every day for the risks their other partners were taking up to their entire net worth. So if one of their partners did something stupid and lost the firm money, it came directly out of their pockets. And they were vulnerable, they were liable up to their entire net worth, their home, their wealth that they had created, their art collection, whatever it was. And what happened was that partnership culture, which resulted, I think, by and large, in prudent risks being taken, not that Wall Street wasn't a dangerous place, but prudent risks being taken, was substituted by what I call this bonus culture, where people on Wall Street were encouraged to take risks with other people's money. And as soon as that happens, the whole dynamic changes. You know, it's one thing to take a risk with your own money and to risk losing it. That's one thing. But when you're rewarded to take risks with somebody else's money and there's no accountability if your bet goes badly, like, you know, you would think that if your bet goes badly and the firm goes out of business, the only instance we had of accountability in this last crisis, frankly, even a little bit of accountability, was in Lehman Brothers when the government allowed Lehman to fail, which is, the way capitalism is supposed to work. And it was the only time in this crisis that there was real accountability, and unfortunately, shareholders and creditors took it on the chin. A lot of employees took it on the chin, too, but then they quickly turned around and sold themselves to Barclays, a big British bank, and now they're making millions in bonuses again. So, the problem is that there is basically, in this new bonus culture on Wall Street, no accountability for people's behavior. And even though there's this 2,200-page new law called the Dodd-Frank Law and new regulations that need to be written to regulate how that law is implemented and what Wall Street firms can and cannot do, the basic incentive structure on Wall Street has not changed one iota. And therefore, I am very pessimistic about, since I'm a student of human nature, I'm very pessimistic that we've, done anything to solve what will inevitably be another crisis on Wall Street in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I can't blame you for your pessimism under the circumstances. Yeah, because, again, this bonus culture does not act as a governor on the worst impulses of some of the folks in there the way that the partner structure had previously. Even the Lehman Brothers thing, when we look at incentives and disincentives in the market here, I'd have an easier time getting behind the notion that Lehman Brothers represented some kind of big lesson to people if it wasn't a deal like eeny, meeny, miny, mo. The government was involved in a lot of bailouts that year, a handful of them after the fact with TARP and things like that. But then the bailouts before that and the backstopping of Fannie Mae and Freddie and everything like that, Lehman just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Collateral damage.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a thing where you can't even look at it that way and say that people are necessarily going to draw the lesson from that. People couldn't draw clear lessons from anything that happened.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, having studied it, you know, I understand why, and at least I can understand the perspective of people like Henry Paulson and Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke, why they did what they did. But in retrospect, and I've written this, I mean, having studied this, I think that the best thing that they could have done, although it would have been, you know, very difficult for them to do, would have been to have let Bear Stearns fail in March of 2008, not come to the rescue of Bear Stearns, because that would have sent a very, very powerful message to the market. And if Dick Fuld at Lehman Brothers or Stan, or then I guess John Thain at Merrill Lynch, did not get that message, well, then shame on them. But instead, the message was that we're going to save Bear Stearns. And you know, I can understand, you know, if you're Dick Fuld or you're John Thain and you're thinking, well, if they save Bear Stearns, which is the smallest of the big financial securities firms, then they've got to save Lehman Brothers. They've got to save Merrill Lynch. And the thing is that was an understandable decision at the time, even though it was the very first time when they saved Bear Stearns. That's the first time in our history that the government had stepped in to save a securities firm. Not a bank, a securities firm. Usually, in the past, until that moment, they'd let securities firms fail, and, of course, the partners lost everything. This is the first time that they decided to save a securities firm, and it sent a very, unfortunately, a very bad message to the market, because it gave the Merrill Lynches of the world, the Lehman Brothers of the world, the Morgan Stanleys of the world, Goldman Sachs of the world, a false sense of security about how they might be bailed out as well. They would have been better off had they just let Bear Stearns fail, and then the message would have redounded in the market loud and clear.
Exactly. You couldn't be more right on that as far as I'm concerned, William, because things would have gotten a chance to shake out as opposed to that whole year where bad examples continued to be set before they let Lehman Brothers fail, and there was unfortunately a lot of bad fallout with that. I have to ask you also, you know, because because I do not have a background in finance, that there are some of these things that I don't fully grasp here. So I'm wondering if I'm reaching perhaps and drawing any lessons from this, but you look at how Lehman Brothers went down and all of the things that happened for a short period of time, really kind of the collapse of global credit. Is there anything that we can learn from that? I understand that municipal bonds and the ones that states and countries have are a different animal, but as you start to get into things now, municipalities potentially going bankrupt in this year, states now in some cases petitioning for the right to be able to do that. There's talk of that being a scenario for California to try to get permission for that if everything else goes awry. Is there anything we can learn from what Lehman Brothers did to the credit markets, what we might be facing, what this might happen with the happen with the bond markets this year?
Well, look, I am, you know, I may be in a minority view on this, but I think it gets back to taking responsibility for your own actions, which to me is, you know, a very important maxim by which to live one's life. I mean, if you borrow money, even on an individual basis, if you take too much credit card debt that you know you can't pay back, if you take out a mortgage that you know you can't pay back, if you're encouraged to do that and it seems too good to be true, it means that it often is. And that idea, that simple kernel of an idea of taking responsibility for your own actions, making sure that you don't borrow money that you can't pay back, that you don't get yourself into a situation that you don't understand, that's the same dynamic, frankly, that works at the bigger level, at the macro level, on Wall Street. These Wall Street firms were entirely too leveraged. They were taking on way too much money that they could not afford to pay back. I mean, the reason Bear Stearns got into trouble, the reason Lehman Brothers got into trouble, the reason Merrill Lynch got into trouble is their entire business model was predicated on the whole idea of borrowing short-term, borrowing in the overnight financing markets. This was a total revelation to me, and I worked on Wall Street for 17 years. I didn't understand this. They're borrowing over in the overnight financing markets. In the case of Bear Stearns, they were borrowing $75 billion a night in the overnight financing markets, and then they would take that money and put it into long-term assets that were rapidly losing value, these mortgage-backed securities or whatever they were, that they could not liquefy fast enough in turn enabled to enable them to run their business. So they effectively gave their overnight creditors, these people who provide this kind of financing for a very small amount of money on a short-term basis, they gave these overnight creditors a vote on whether to continue to do business with Bear Stearns. And the same thing happened with Lehman, and the same thing happened with Merrill. And the reason these firms went out of business so quickly, you know, Bear Stearns went out of business in 3 days. Lehman went out of business seemingly over the weekend. The reason they went out of business so quickly is because their short-term creditors just said, we're not going to finance you anymore. I mean, that is the craziest way to run a business that you could ever imagine. I mean, can you imagine personally if your creditors were on your butt every day, you know, every day after day after day saying, you know, you can't eat. You're not going to have enough money to eat unless you pay me back today, and I'm not going to give you money tomorrow unless you pay me back the next day. Well, that's what Wall Street was doing. And there is certainly a lesson to be learned from that. But the truth is they won't learn the lesson because that kind of financing, that kind of structure is very cheap, inexpensive financing because it's short-term financing. And it would cost them a lot more to finance their business long-term. And so, you know, they get seduced by the opportunity of short-term profits and big bonuses, and they don't think about the long-term survivability and viability of their company. So, I mean, I think that if we each took more responsibility for our own behavior and made sure that our own financial houses, you know, let alone ethical or moral houses, are in order, you know, we would be far better off because that would be a message that could be heard loud and clear. And by the way, I think that, you know, from what my father growing up in the Depression, you know, the stories that he's told me, that it seems to me, you know, the great generation that Tom Brokaw wrote about, these are the, you know, it seems that America was built on one of these pillars, but we seem to have lost it in the last generation, and it's just a shame.
Yeah, we very clearly have. And again, chalk me up as somebody who's very grateful that we don't live on an individual system like that. And I certainly have a lot of friends who are grateful that for day-to-day purposes, we don't have to justify our financial lives. You're right. That would be a heck of a way for individuals to have to live. And it's no way for businesses to conduct themselves. The next question I'm going to ask you is one where, you know, frankly, because I can be a little bit of an alarmist, so maybe I'm not going to want to hear the answer to it. But I think our viewers certainly want to get at the truth if we possibly can with you, and that is when you were on previously, it was you know, maybe what, 8 months after the events of September 2008, and you said at the time, and this squared with everything that I had been reading, that we didn't even necessarily know the situation with all of the banks and the institutions involved, to the extent to which some things were still kind of muddy, to which the mortgage securitization maybe still had some of them in a bad position that wasn't yet known. I mean, it's about a year and a half from that point on. We're hearing that this is going to be the worst year yet for mortgage defaults. Again, from my outside perspective, I mean, I just have a churning feeling in my gut. I know that corporate profits have been up a lot over the course of the last 2 years, but as quickly as it returned to business as usual, which we talked about during your present during your past time on the show here, I just have this gnawing feeling that we still haven't necessarily gotten to the bottom of everything that went wrong in that instance, and that there could still be vestiges of that crisis that come back to bite us in the next year or two. Is there anything to that fear, do you think?
Well, I don't think, you know, a lot of people would like, as we talked about before, would like to quickly have us return to the status quo and act as though as everything, you know, is hunky-dory, that we're, you know, we're back from the brink, you know, we're so much better off now than we were in September and October of 2008. And I'm not saying that that isn't true to some extent, but I think there are some serious, serious structural problems that still exist, not only in our economy, but, you know, frankly, in the European economies and the world economies. You know, there's a serious sovereign crisis in Europe, whether it's in you know, in Ireland, in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, and potentially Italy. I mean, there are real problems both with the banks, the financial institutions, and the sovereign countries themselves. And we know that there are problems in our own states, in terms, as you were mentioning before, in terms of, you know, financial deficits that they cannot overcome. And look at what we've done, you know, at the federal level. I mean, this wonderful tax cut deal that everybody is, you know, jumping up and down and getting so excited about that happened during the lame duck session, you know, has increased the 2011 budget deficit to $1.5 trillion. You know, there's a record budget deficit, and, you know, there doesn't seem to be the political will. There's a lot of jawboning about it, but there doesn't seem to be the political will in Congress to do anything to close those deficits. And the hope is that we can just continue to finance our deficits with, you know, the Chinese or the Japanese or the Koreans who are kind enough to buy our debt, or the Federal Reserve, which is kind enough to buy our debt. So I think there's, and to say nothing of unemployment and the chronic levels of unemployment, I think there are huge problems. Now, you talked about whether, you know, any of the mortgage securities and people are still increasing number of people are losing their homes through foreclosure. And I think it's a crime that banks aren't willing to negotiate with individual homeowners a new a mortgage for their homes, reduced mortgage with reduced rates to get those payments back on track where it can be a performing loan. I mean, why they do it for GM and Chrysler, but don't do it for individual homeowners, you know, is beyond me. But I think that basically at the moment, what's going on at the bank level is that the banks took such big write-downs on the value of these securities that part of the reason they're showing great profits in the last few quarters is because they're reversing those losses, and as the value of these securities increases, they're taking some of those gains into their balance sheets, into their P&L. And I think that, you know, it's accounting gimmickry. I think there is a fundamental, you know, proper shift going on now towards less risk-taking on Wall Street than there had been and becoming more like utilities. I mean, once upon a time, Wall Street provided a very, very valuable service for corporate America, which was raising capital anywhere in the world, whenever they wanted it, 24/7, you know, providing capital to these companies so they could grow, they could build new plant and equipment, they could hire more workers, so they could do all the things that we would like them to do now, but don't do. Really, doesn't seem that they do anymore. Now, it seems that Wall Street, by and large, you know, maybe some of this will be stopped to some extent, but had become a huge casino, as you were saying before, and that's not very productive. That's and again, it gets back to this bonus culture where the incentive was, and remains on Wall Street, to take big risks with other people's money. Anytime you put humans in a situation where they're being rewarded for taking big risks without any accountability, it doesn't take a genius to realize that that's exactly what they're going to do. And so, you know, until we change the incentives on Wall Street, we're never really going to change the risk that Wall Street poses to us.
No, I think those are very good points. And the last question I've got for you, William, maybe along similar lines here. A friend of our show we've had on a couple of different times, Joe DiGuardi, former congressman and, of course, a candidate for Senate in New York last year. In talking with him, and I'm broadly sympathetic to many of the things that he talked about, but the last time he was on, when he was talking about auditing the Fed, I said, look, I'm with you on this, but I said, I have a great fear of what happens if we find out the emperor's got no clothes. I think that could be very destabilizing. From what I've read and from what I believe, I think that there are some things to what he's talking about what the Fed has done and some of the things that they've done that are probably not what you would want to see in a free market society. But I fear the loss of confidence that can come if all of their deeds are uncovered. The market can, of course, be so destabilized by a lack of confidence. Is that a fear that you think is justified?
Well, I think that fear, while justified, is trumped by the, you know, Louis Brandeis's statement that sunlight is the best disinfectant. You know, the Fed has operated in the shadows for a very long time. I mean, it would be very interesting. You should see if you can get William Greider on, who wrote a book called Secrets of the Temple, the Rolling Stone writer, Secrets of the Temple, about how the Fed operates. I mean, the Fed was created and basically owned by the banking system, by the private banks, by the private sector banks. And there's a reason it does what it does. There's a reason that it makes cheap financing available to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan and all these other companies, because basically it exists for their benefit. I think that the more we can know about the way the Fed operates, and I think it's a tremendous mystery. It's the most secretive, you know, part of our government, I think. You know, even though it's had so much scrutiny, you know, in the last couple of years because of the crisis, I think it's, you know, completely opaque. And I do, I know they've resisted this relentlessly, but I think, you know, Ron Paul is really onto something by asking for, you know, more of transparency with regard to the Fed and an audit of the Fed. The Fed has never been audited, and I think there, you know, it would really be refreshing. I just get back to the fact that even though it might be scary to find out what really goes on at the Fed, I think we are entitled to know, and we will be in better shape, you know, having that information and dealing with things we find that we don't like. And I'm not saying there is anything. I'm just saying there might be something, as you pointed out, and we would be better off if we can confront instead of, you know. I always get concerned, and I had a piece in the New York Times, you know, in June of 2010, where I talked about, maybe it was June of 2009, where I talked about this. Yes, it was. You know, where. I talked about having a morphine drip in our arms, you know, the where we were anesthetized to what was really going on. And I really believe that you know, I've tried to, you know, pull back the curtain on these Wall Street firms and the way they behave. And I tried to do that in my first book, in my second book, and I think in the Goldman book, same thing. You can open up these black boxes, understand what people are doing there, what motivates them, what they're motivated by, how they behave, the kind of people who want to work there, and the kind of people who then go on from there to high roles in our government. I think until we really understand that, we can't prevent that behavior. We can't begin to change that behavior that really isn't doing us much good right now. And so, you know, we've got to educate ourselves about what's going on before we can begin to correct it. So I would say, open the Fed. Let's audit the Fed. Let's see what's going on at the Fed. Let's see what's going on at all these Wall Street firms. Let's make the balance sheets and the income statements more transparent, more information. Let's not have less. Let's go back to Louis Brandeis. You know, sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear from you that we would be better off if that happened. It looks like that there may be a chance of that passing through in this Congress, so maybe we won't have anything to fear if it does. But, William, just always a pleasure having you on here, of course, following your work as a contributing editor at Fortune Magazine, that great piece in Vanity Fair about the origins of Facebook, your new book coming out about Goldman Sachs. Just a pleasure talking about any of these things with you. It just always adds a nice element to the show whenever we can have you on and talk about any of these matters, and I look forward to doing it again. Thank you so much.
Please, anytime. Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, the great William Cohen, everybody. We really love having him on the program, and we thank him for his time here tonight.